From WBUR Boston, this is Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Deborah Becker. Each week, we bring you the best of Boston University from the worlds of scholarship, letters, politics, and the arts. Tonight, openings, a lecture by Jeffrey Hamburger, Kuno Franke, professor of German art and culture at Harvard University.
Before turning to the aesthetic and expressive possibilities of the opening, we need to consider the challenges that this new framework presented for the makers, readers, and given that we are dealing with manuscripts, that is, handmade books, the copyists of books. Only when we understand how the opening was made can we understand how it was used.
Openings with Harvard University Professor Jeffrey Hamburger tonight on Boston University's World of Ideas. First, this news. Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Deborah Becker. Tonight, we have a lecture presented by the Program in Scripture and the Arts in the Department of Religion at Boston University. Speaking will be Jeffrey Hamburger, Kuno Franke Professor of German Art and Culture at Harvard University. Professor Hamburger's lecture is titled Openings. We begin with an introduction by Department of Religion Chair Diana Klepper.
It is truly a pleasure to be able to introduce our speaker today, Jeffrey Hamburger, the Kuno Frank Professor of German Art and Culture at Harvard University. And I suspect that most of you here today probably do not need this introduction, because you probably already know that you're in for a treat. I'm going to tell you a little bit of all the stuff I must say about a speaker. He holds both a BA and a PhD in art history from Yale University. He taught previously at Oberlin College and the University of Toronto. He has been a guest professor in Zurich and Paris and Oxford. His work on high and later medieval European art explores intersections between art and theology, text and image, vision and imagination, with a particular contribution to our understanding of women's use of religious imagery. As a testament to the remarkable quality of Jeffrey's talent, his first three books, published within an eight-year span, which for medievalists, that in itself is absolutely shocking, each one of them earned at least two prestigious awards. His first book, based on his dissertation, The Rothschild Canticles, Art and Mysticism in Flanders and the Rhineland circa 1300, which was published by Yale in 1990, won the Alt Award in Humanities by the Council of Graduate Schools and the John Nicholas Brown Prize of the Medieval Academy of America. His second book, Nuns as Artists, The Visual Culture of a Medieval Convent, published by the University of California Press in 1996, was awarded the Jacques Barzun Prize in Cultural History of the American Philosophical Society and the Otto Grundler Prize of the International Congress of Medieval Studies. His third book, and one beloved by students of my mysticism seminar here, The Visual and the Visionary, Art and Female Spirituality in Late Medieval Germany, published by Zone Books in 1998, was awarded the Charles Rufus Murray Prize of the College Art Association and the Roland H. Baton Book Prize in Art and Music. Not many of us can say the same. Pretty remarkable publishing record. He's published other books, wonderful books since then. One edited volume I particularly want to mention for its importance is the 2005 Princeton edition, The Mind's Eye, Art and Theological Argument in the Medieval West. Jeffrey has received numerous awards, fellowships, a Guggenheim, American Philosophical Society grant, NEH, a Humboldt, etc., etc., elected a fellow of the Medieval Academy of America in 2001, and this is the point when he's wondering when all this will end, that I have to also say that more than being a brilliant scholar, a wonderful writer, he is a generous, encouraging, wonderful colleague, really has been supportive of historians like myself daring to tread into art historical waters, has an incredible photographic memory so that if you step into his office showing him an image and asking some opinions about it, he's likely to be able to point to 20 different places on his vast bookshelves where there will be similar images. Just remarkable. And with that, I leave you in his capable hands. Jeffrey Hamburger, thank you.
Besides the headline, "Books Aren't Dead, They're Just Going Digital," a recent cover to Newsweek featured an impish Jeff Bezos peeking out from behind his new product, the Amazon Kindle. The cover story, which blatantly substituted advertising for news, reported breathlessly that, quote, "the handheld device can hold several shelves worth of books, 200 of them on board, hundreds more on a memory card, and a limitless amount in virtual stacks maintained by Amazon." Progress cannot be prevented, but Bezos is right when he adds, quote, "the book just turns out to be an incredible device." There is one thing, a very important thing, that Kindle cannot do that every conventional book can, and that is open. A book's ability to open is not something we can take for granted. A viral video clip on YouTube, some of you may have seen it, the Medieval Help Desk, in which a hapless monk learns how to open a book, is illustrative of this. What makes the clip so funny, besides its all too typical way of mocking monks, is that it belabors the obvious. So obvious, in fact, that whereas a great deal of ink has been spilled on the layout of the single page, hardly anything has been said about the opening as such. Before we congratulate ourselves on being so much cleverer than the befuddled monk, we need to remind ourselves that the single page constitutes only half of the visual field provided by the handheld book. The Newsweek cover acknowledges this fact by showing only half of Jeff Bezos's face. The electronic tablet takes the place of one of his eyes. The book that opens, however, is binocular, and this, it could be said, by way of extending the metaphor, is what gives it its depth. It is those depths that I'd like to explore with you this evening by tracing the millennium-long history of the medieval book as a vehicle for exploring the experience of opening, understood not only as a practice requiring the laying on of hands, embracing the book as a physical object, but also as a concept that extends to encompass the idea of revelation itself. The 15th century French Wharncliffe Hours on your right is separated from the Carolingian Vivian Bible by the better part of a millennium, but the underlying conception of the open book as the source of salvation remains the same. In the Apocalypse, John declares, "And I saw in the right hand of him that sat on the throne a book written within and without, sealed with seven seals. And I saw a strong angel proclaiming, 'Who is worthy to open the book and loose the seals thereof?'" In the Vivian Bible, the enthroned book forms the focal point for the symbols of the four evangelists, the Lamb of God and the Lion of Judah, both symbols of Christ. A miniature added to this 11th century Psalter in Amiens harks back to this Carolingian precedent by placing the sealed book within a curtain space evocative of the Ark of the Covenant. The seven seals, barely visible on the binding, are matched by the seven gifts of the Holy Spirit that radiate from the beak of the bird perched within the temple, signs of what will become manifest once the seals are opened. This tension between opening and closing, revelation and concealment, is a constant of Christian art. Consider, for example, this curious representation of Moses at the Ark in a late 14th century copy of Rudolf of Ems' World Chronicle, now in the Getty Museum. God emerges from a cloud, a customary method of underscoring his invisibility, in this case enhanced by our being unable to see him face to face, but rather what Exodus describes as his back parts. Jehovah, however, bears a cross halo, identifying him with the triune God of Christianity. Directed by the prophet's complex and curious chiastic gesture, when we turn to the ark itself, which remains closed, the cherubs, far from sheltering its contents with their wings, open a very Christian triptych that sits atop the propitiatory. Like Moses himself, the image looks backwards and forwards. It simultaneously represents the closed book of the Old Testament, Jewish scripture, yet anticipates the open book of the New. And what was it like to witness the opening of an apocalyptic book? This sweeping opening from an early medieval Beatus captures the visionary intensity of the text. The Beatus was a commentary on the book of Revelation. A more prosaic 15th century Flemish apocalypse comes closer to offering something akin to Jeff Bezos' vision of heaven as an ethereal library. For grandeur, however, the golden codex illuminated at Echternach in the second quarter of the 11th century has no rival. The gigantic tome opened by the angel, whose outspread wings match those of the symbol of St. Matthew on the facing page, bears a poem in praise of the sacred scribe. In the Codex Gigas, or Giant Codex, sometimes known as the Devil's Bible, because according to legend, a book of this magnitude, 90 by 50 centimeters, the largest extant medieval manuscript, was only completed with the help of the devil depicted in its pages. The 12 gates of the heavenly Jerusalem stand in contrast to the void of hell. The scribe Cosmas, a monk at the Bohemian monastery of Podlasice, who wrote the Codex as an act of penance over the course of the first quarter of the 13th century, felt himself confronted by the basic choice represented by this overwhelming opening. The association of reading with Revelation would never have taken hold had not the experience of opening and entering the space of the book, real and imaginary, itself been so profound. The experiential and symbolic dimensions of reading come together in the most famous account of taking up a book in all of Western literature, Augustine's description of his conversion in the Confessions. Overcome by remorse for his sins, Augustine heard from a neighboring house a voice, he says, as of a boy or girl I know not, chanting and oft repeating, tole lege, take up and read. Here you see the passage is painted by Benozzo Gozzoli, but the imagery of light that follows is more adequately captured by Rembrandt's intimate portrait of his mother as the biblical prophetess Hannah. Augustine continues, "So checking the torrent of my tears, I arose, interpreting it to be no other than a command from God to open the book and read the first chapter I should find." He says that it happens to have been a passage in Paul. "No further would I read, nor needed I." It's this passage to which Dante refers in the Inferno, another couple who reads no further, but for very different reasons. "For instantly at the end of this sentence, by a light, as it were, of serenity infused into my heart, all the darkness of doubt vanished away." Augustine's conversion took place in the late 4th century, a time in which the experience of opening a book and turning its pages remained relatively novel. In the popular imagination, late antiquity is a period associated with decline and fall, yet when it comes to the history of the book, it was a period of tremendous technological innovation. As is well known, in antiquity, the Codex, the book as we know it, did not exist. Written texts were recorded on tablets and transmitted on scrolls. In fact, the term Codex, derived from caudex, the Latin word for tree trunk or block of wood, originally referred to another ancient technology for recording the written word, the tablet, whether made of clay or wax in a wooden frame. Tablets such as this, complete with styli with blunt ends to be used as erasers, have been recovered in excavations. In addition to permitting quilt calculations, tablets allowed the recording of drafts in shorthand, the practice of court stenographers today. The oral performance of text remains a part of our experience. Witness the fact that I'm reading to you here today, ex cathedra, as it were. We still associate the spoken word with authority. At least I hope you do. It is too simple to say, however, with McLuhan, that the medium determined the message. The fundamental shift from the spoken to the written word and corresponding changes in the ways in which literature of all kinds were recorded and experienced unfolded gradually over the course of centuries. Nonetheless, the Codex lent itself to illustration in ways the scroll did not. We witness the impact of the new format in the 6th century Greek Dioscurides, a herbal and bestiary. Adjacent text columns give way to long lines spanning the width of pages, facing full-page frontispieces and illustrations set within frames that double the implicit boundary defined by the edges, thereby creating a hierarchy of spaces in terms of borders, margins, and other pictorial equivalents of what Gerard Janet, in another context, called paratexts, the liminal devices and conventions both within and outside the book that form part of the complex mediation between book, author, and reader. Roles never entirely lost their place in the book culture of the Middle Ages. The exalted roles of southern Italy represent only the most famous exceptions to the rule. Whenever oral performance, teaching, recitation, commemoration was required, roles played a part for symbolic as well as practical purposes. For the most part, however, the triumph of the Codex was complete. In addition to being more convenient, it was also more comprehensive. One could contain the entire Bible, an entire library or bibliotheca, in a single manuscript known as a pandect. The contrast between roll and codex often was used to underscore the difference between eras, not antiquity in the Middle Ages, but rather the old and new law. In the Gospels of Santa Maria ad Gradus, illuminated in Cologne around 1030, the Christ Logos at the center and St. Mark to his right hold codices, whereas the prophets in the corners hold scrolls. The distinction acquires a sharper ideological edge in a 15th century French translation of the liturgist Durandus, in which the pagans worship idols on the right, the Jews in the center a giant scroll, and Christians the Trinity in the form of the throne of mercy. A similar mode of argument informs the marriage of Mary and Joseph in the Aspremont Hours, a late 13th century French manuscript in which an open codex and closed scroll sit side by side on the altar, identifying the couple's alliance as the moment at which the history of Christian salvation begins to unfold. The roll was also used more generally as a symbol of inspired speech or divine inspiration. We find it, for example, in the opposing pairs of portraits in the Praxipostolos, the Acts and Epistles, of Innocent VIII, a late 13th century Byzantine manuscript in which James, Peter, and John are presented as ancient orators, holding open books while making dramatic gestures of speech. In contrast, Luke writes on an incongruous, unfurled scroll. In the Byzantine book, the paired figures do not engage with each other, let alone across the space of the gutter dividing verso from recto. They stand as isolated icons. A 12th century Crusader gospel book offers a more dynamic exploitation of the opening. The four evangelists break out of the iconic mold by turning away from the viewer to face the canon table. The evangelists seem to take their cue from a manuscript such as the Sacramentary of Charles the Bald, illuminated in Metz around 870, in which the heavenly choirs, joining in the singing of the Sanctus, defer to the frontal image of Christ in majesty on the facing page. The imitation jewels of the frames not only refer to contemporary treasure bindings, they also evoke the heavenly Jerusalem. Before turning to the aesthetic and expressive possibilities of the opening, we need to consider the challenges that this new framework presented for the makers, readers, and given that we are dealing with manuscripts, that is, handmade books, the copyists of books. Only when we understand how the opening was made can we understand how it was used. One could argue that openings represent diptychs of a kind produced in late antiquity in enormous numbers, for example, in the form of ivory consular diptychs. Diptychs continued to be employed throughout the Middle Ages, although by the time this curious hybrid was made for Philip the Bold, they were quite rare. Philip's combined prayer book and diptych opens in changing constellations, in this case to a miniature showing the patron at prayer in front of a larger diptych on an altar. In the medieval West, the diptych was particularly indebted to Byzantine models. Nevertheless, the so-called Byzantine diptych in the Winchester Psalter, produced for Henry of Blois, or so it is said, in the middle of the 12th century, represents an adaptation, not a direct copy of Eastern prototypes. Witness the French titles. And these French titles atop the miniatures, the one on the right says, Ici est fait reine del ciel, provide, I think, fairly conclusive indication that the manuscript could not have been made for the Bishop of Winchester, who would have had no need for a French gloss. Most likely the manuscript was made for a woman. A Saxon Psalter of the mid-13th century, in which icon-like busts of Christ and Mary, accompanied by verses derived from the Song of Songs, confront each other across the opening so that they could be thought of as kissing one another when the book was closed, represents a later generation of Byzantine imports. But here, too, however, we are dealing with a Western adaptation, not a copy. The opening represented a challenge and a spur to creativity. The challenge of the opening becomes more apparent if we consider its codicology, that is, its construction. What you see here is a diagram from a popular introduction to that proverbial bestseller, The Book of Hours, that purports to explain how frames and borders were laid out across openings. The diagram seeks to demonstrate how, in a few simple steps, beginning with the drawing of a diagonal across two pages, a craftsman could establish the narrower and wider borders surrounding the miniature. But as you can well imagine, it isn't so simple. In fact, very few openings match this diagram, and with good reason. In looking at any gathering, we cannot assume that the two facing pages forming a bifolium, that is, two conjoint leaves, were prepared simultaneously or would have faced one another in the final product. As can be seen from this diagram, which includes a canceled leaf, and this 15th century portrayal of a scribe at work on a single bifolium in his rather posh atelier, facing pages would only have come to confront one another after individual bifolia had been prepared, ruled, and nested one within the next to form a gathering, and any single leaves bearing miniatures had been tipped in. Any opening that didn't happen to lie at the center of a gathering had to be constructed from disparate elements. Opportunities for error were legion. There was, of course, nothing to prevent an illustrator from adding images after a manuscript had been assembled. This book of ours from Tours, painted by a follower of Jean Fouquet around 1470, offers an especially sophisticated example. The miniature of the Virgin on the left was tipped in on a single leaf without ruling to face a page that originally was intended to contain script. Cast shadows on the floor behind the figures and in the gutter behind the frame unite the two sides of the opening by suggesting a common light source. These shadows were added by the second artist as an attempt to bind the two pages together. A late 14th century Bavarian world chronicle offers a less accomplished, but no less revealing example. The artist places Pharaoh and his troops drowning in the Red Sea in the gutter at the center, leaving Moses and the Israelites high and dry in the margin. Borders were added with a quick stroke of the brush. In this copy of the Chronicle of Constance by Ulrich Riechenthal, the book is organized around panoramic images, here of long liturgical processions spanning several openings in succession. This brought with it problems. On the one hand, it's a very effective cinematic device. On the other hand, because the procession proceeds left to right, the emperor and the pope, the most important people, are the last that the reader would encounter, which you could say was an act of artistic lèse majesté. In theory, one should have encountered them first, and yet the narrative flow of this panoramic image dictated that they come last, and the artist experimented with various solutions in trying to solve this problem. A panel of the Evangelist Mark by the early 16th century Westphalian painter Ludger Thom Ring, whose fascination with books appears to have been closely tied up with the transition from manuscript to print, reveals the sensitivity of craftsmen to the technology of their times. No doubt today, the Annunciation would have come by text messaging. At first glance, the painting presents us with a conventional evangelist portrait. But if you look closely, however, you'll see that the piece of parchment on which Mark writes is not a bifolium, but rather a sheet folded to form part of a quarto. Rather than writing across the central fold with all the lines arrayed accordingly, Ring's evangelist prepares two pages whose upper edges meet across the horizontal fold. In short, Ring's scribe employs the system sometimes used by scribes, but more often by printers, known as imposition, which allowed entire gatherings to be printed in one pull from the press before being folded and cut. Consider the contrast with this still life, also by Ring, which embodies nostalgia for craft traditions that were rapidly becoming obsolete. Still life is perhaps a misnomer, since the manuscript, which seems to radiate a light all of its own, seems to come to life. What we see is a conspectus of openings, the early modern equivalent of a turning the pages installation. Script, ruling, initials, fleurnet decoration, the cadels in the border, these are these elaborate penwork flourishes that you see here. Chant, notations, binding, leather straps, all are carefully recorded. We even get a glimpse of a full-page miniature. Not much, but just enough, the skull at the foot of the cross and the lower limbs of the evangelist John, to recognize it as the crucifixion, marking the canon that identifies this manuscript as a missal. In effect, what Ring has done is remove and isolate an element found in genre paintings of the period, for example, Jan Metsys's painting of a moneylender and his wife, in which the wife is distracted from her pious reading by the gold that, along with her salvation, hangs in the balance. Whereas in Metsys's painting, dated 1514, the woman's curiosity threatens to be her downfall, in Ring's painting, the book instead appeals to our sense of wonder. In both works, however, the books have something of the archaeological artifact about them. Metsys's, moreover, and I show it to you here in an inverted detail, is a pastiche, whereas the initial with the Agnus Dei suggests it is of 14th century French origin. This is very typical 14th century French decoration. The half-length Virgin and Child on the facing page resembles Italian Madonnas of the late 13th century. The Virgin with a book in her hands provides a countermodel to the foolish banker's wife. Once a book had been assembled into a series of ordered openings, its contents were still not easily mastered. One has to recall that all the aids to reading that we take for granted, pagination, foliation, tables of contents, let alone indices, were relatively late inventions. Some, for example, the headers that run across openings or wraparound glosses, such as those in this 12th century Pentateuch made for Thomas à Becket around 1170, are precocious in marking the opening as the critical visual field. Another such device is the bookmark. Computer technology has made virtual bookmarks as familiar as scrolling, yet they are as ancient as the oldest Coptic codices. Bookmarks provided a welcome alternative to the practices condemned by a 13th century bibliophile, Richard de Bury, who in his Philo Biblon castigated, and I quote, "headstrong youths who distribute a multitude of straws inserted to stick out in different places so that the helm may remind them of what their memory cannot retain." La plus ça change, we might say. But in fact, de Bury's remark reminds us of the role of memory in monastic culture at precisely the point when, under the pressure of new scholastic habits of reading and writing, novel forms of reference were required. Bookmarks were especially useful in liturgical books, such as a breviary, and open our eyes to another salient characteristic of the codex, the ease with which it permits cross-referencing in the form of flipping back and forth. This nonlinear way of reading is especially important in the liturgy. In the High Middle Ages, liturgical texts previously distributed in different books among different performers were assembled between two covers, in the case of the Mass, the Missal, and in the case of the Divine Office in the breviary. Texts once celebrated communally could now be performed privately. And this kind of compilation permitted not only portability, which is the reason usually given, particularly in the context of mendicant culture, for the origins of both Missal and breviary. It also allowed the privatization of prayer. So we can actually say that it is only but one step from the Missal and the breviary to books such as the Book of Hours. Bookmarks rarely survive, primarily because they were lost as soon as books were rebound. They occur most frequently in commentaries in which they facilitated the complex combinatorics involved in reading what were, in effect, several books crammed between two covers. Scholars' bookmarks, however, differ from liturgical bookmarks. Rather than multiple strips of silk designed to enable quick cross-referencing among several openings, they take the form of vauvelles, a small rotating circle attached to a strip of parchment. This example comes from a 12th century copy of Gilbert de la Porée's commentary on the Pauline epistles. It's now in the Harvard University Library. Still in its original binding, the manuscript is adorned with numerous ornate initial P's that mark the name of the apostolic author. The complex layout, in which marginal and interlinear commentaries engulf and overwhelm the scriptural source, itself is a product of an advanced culture of the codex, in which, as Ivan Illich observed, this visual architecture of the ordinatio makes it increasingly necessary when reading to have the book under one's eyes. Using this particular form of bookmark, a reader or copyist could find column and line quickly. Whereas the strip itself marks an opening, the vowel, which slides up and down the strip, marks a spot along the vertical axis plotted out by line after line of script. Last but not least, the rotating circle, which in this case has been restored, permits one to indicate column 1, 2, 3, or 4. The bookmark identifies not the page, but rather the opening as the critical semantic unit. Semantics bring us to meaning and expression. The codex allowed the illustrated book to come into its own. As soon as we recognize that within the codex the page was addressed to the eye as well as to the ear, all sorts of visual elements that might otherwise escape our attention quickly come into focus. Take, for example, these two openings from on top, the Codex Caesariensis, a 6th century Syrian Gospels, and on the bottom, an 8th century Gallican Missal. The Syriac Gospels, written in silver on purple parchment, already betray some departures from the classic continuous columnar presentation of script found in antique scrolls. For example, the use of gold for rubrics and nomina sacra, and of silver for the Eusebian sections, as well as in large letters at the beginnings of chapters that protrude into the margin. In its lack of spacing and punctuation, however, this is still a book that cedes more to the conventions of oral recitation than to the visual articulation of the text. In contrast, the Gallican Missal introduces a host of elements that will all enjoy a long afterlife in the later Middle Ages. In addition to florid capital letters in various sizes, the scribe employs a hierarchy of scripts, unseal and display capitals, distantly derived from Roman epigraphy, as well as paragraph indentations, punctuation, and word spacing to structure our experience of the page. In the second quarter of the 11th century, the monks of Saint Vaast produced a large lectern Bible that harked back to Carolingian precedents. Unlike Carolingian Pandex, however, which opened with a full-page frontispiece for Genesis and occasionally Exodus as well, the first images in the Saint Vaast Bible introduced Deuteronomy. Across the top of both pages, in the spandrels outside the double-lobed frames that enclose the text, we see two scenes in which God hands the law down to Moses, whereas in the initial itself and in the lower spandrels, we see vignettes from untamed nature, birds and serpents in combat, and on the left, a hunter sounding his horn. The imagery of sound is taken up by the opening words, which are highlighted in large letters. These are the words which Moses spoke to all Israel. The hunting imagery could perhaps be read as referring to, quote, the plain wilderness over against the Red Sea, where, according to the first verse, Moses instructed the Israelites in the law. Moses and Jehovah are marginal figures, however. The opening confronts the law of nature and the law of God. Despite appearances, however, nature does not have the upper hand. Read from left to right, the opening, whose semicircular forms actually suggest the shape of the mosaic tablets, affects the transition from the violence and unchecked exuberance of nature to the discipline of law. Even the lions at the lower right seem to obey. Male and female, adorned in perfect symmetry, they are forever kept apart by the letter of the law. In an opening such as this, the text literally conforms to what might be called not the law of the frame, a problematic term, but rather the imperative of the opening. Here is another still more spectacular example from the Gospel of Henry II, written in Regensburg before 1024. The format should by now be familiar. Text and image are embedded one within the other. The image on the left of the emperor, surrounded by personifications, echoes the forms of the IN monogram on the right that marks the beginning of John's Gospel. In a characteristic inversion, the text, far from occupying the center or running from left to right, itself forms the frame. The image of the emperor draws on representations of Christ in majesty, surrounded by symbols of the four evangelists, a Christomorphism accentuated by the dove descending from clouds immediately above his crowned head, and the scene of justice beneath his feet. The monarch, the image implies, is Christ's viceroy on earth, in whom by proxy the logos on the right takes on visible form. In all of these examples, a similar formal scheme, dependent on principles derived from diagrammatic imagery, is employed to create images of unrivaled aesthetic and exegetic complexity. Diagrammatic imagery, however, could be used in a variety of ways. The illumination of openings by no means depended on the diagrammatic mode. Narrative imagery could also be used to unite verso and recto into a unified visual field. In its combination of narrative and iconic modes, the opening draws on a tradition in German illumination rich in imperial resonance. In the early 11th century Pericope book of Henry II, a similar format is employed, not only for the Adoration of the Magi, which you see here, but for the Three Marys at the tomb, and not least the overpowering Last Judgment. The most elaborate variation in this particular key occurs in the commentary on the Song of Songs from the library of Otto III, now in Bamberg, but like the Emperor's Gospel book, illuminated at Reichenau around 1000. Facing the frontal figure of Christ, ensconced in the letter O of the opening Osculator, a long procession of clerics and laymen winds its way along a Via Crucis that originates in a baptismal font at the center of the facing page. The Trinity also looms large in the mystical compendium known as the Rothschild Canticles, in which the soul's ascent to God is staged across at least 51 openings that combine on the right a full-page miniature and on the prior page a series of short texts nestled around a smaller miniature of a seer who enacts the process of reading and vision for the viewer. As the openings unfold in successive fashion, the images function rather like a slow-motion kaleidoscope in which anthropomorphic representations of the Trinity gradually disappear amidst a welter of flames, rays, and veils, until in the end, nothing remains visible except the geometric abstraction representing the Deus absconditus, the hidden God. The seers who enact this process for the viewer twist, turn, and gyrate as they try to shelter their eyes from the blinding light of the divinity. From exegesis and vision, I would now like to turn briefly to another way of exploring and exploiting the opening, namely typology. Typology is a term that defines the way in which Christian exegetes understood the relationship between the Old and New Testaments. Events in the Old Testament, figures or types, were read as prophecies and anticipations of events in the life of Christ, the antitypes. We shouldn't, however, read typology simply as content that is, as it were, poured into the opening. Rather, the opening lent itself to the elaboration of typology's oppositional structures of reading. Witness these two 12th century images of the prophet Isaiah heralding the coming of Christ in the form of the tree of Jesse, on the left in the 12th century Siegburg lectionary, and on the right in the commentary on Jerome from Citeaux. Some copies of the enormously influential typological handbook, the Speculum Humanae Salvationis, or Mirror of Man's Salvation, exploit the oppositional character of the opening as a way of underscoring typological relationships by visual means. In this early 14th century copy from Kremsmünster in Austria, four images depicting the Nativity and its types are laid out in a band with alternating red and blue backgrounds, against which the scenes from salvation history stand out in stark silhouettes. The layout heightens an unusual feature of this copy, the juxtaposition in adjoining columns of a German vernacular translation with a Latin original. A mid-14th century copy in Darmstadt goes further in uniting all the images on a single opening, using visual simulacra to make what otherwise might seem like far-fetched comparisons between unfamiliar passages in Scripture more convincing. The scenes are knit together by a chiastic structure that links the two trees at the lower left and upper right along one diagonal and the two figural scenes at upper left and lower right along the other. Typological openings linked the physical fact of opening the book with the idea of revelation. They are, moreover, by no means limited to typological compendia. The Annunciation in the Très Riche of Jean-Duc de Berry only acquires its full meaning when confronted with the preceding page. Too often we see these images in isolation. The fall and expulsion from paradise that depicts the Garden of Eden in the guise of an elaborate piece of Parisian metalwork. Similar juxtapositions mark the opening of the Hours of the Virgin in numerous later 15th century French books of hours. For example, this one by Jean Colombe in the New York Public Library, played out against an architectural backdrop filled with scenes from the life of the Virgin and framed by statues of Adam and Eve in a manner reminiscent of Jan van Eyck's Ghent altarpiece. In a late 15th century book of hours from Tours, the two miniatures represent a collaboration amongst three artists. We have the prophets on the left, and then on the right, an Annunciation in which the figures, but the figures only, were painted by Jean Verduchon. The juxtaposition of Eve and Mary had deep roots, especially in prayer books made for women. It opens the lengthy prefatory cycle in the early 12th century Psalter of Christina of Marquiate, otherwise known as the St. Albans Psalter. In all these books, the Trebuchet included, Ava, Eve, is opposed to Mary's Ave, as in the Ave Maria. Just as the angelic salutation reverses the spelling of Eve's name, so too the incarnation represents a point of reversal and renewal in salvation history. As we have seen, frames play a critical role as mediating devices in medieval manuscripts. This makes the absence of a frame in the Lambourg's expulsion from paradise that much more striking. In contrast to the Gothic temple in which the Virgin receives the angelic salutation, the orb of paradise appears as a self-contained space, visible yet inaccessible, ringed by mountains and clouds. Elsewhere, the Lambourgs manipulate the frame across openings, both to enhance spatial illusion, yet at the same time to remind us of their role as mediators of our experience. For example, the sequence showing Christ entering, then exiting the praetorium, begins with a miniature in which Christ stands still at the center amidst the crowd that sweeps towards the closed door. Two openings later, we emerge with Christ on the other side. On the left, he exits the praetorium. On the right, the city gates. In the first miniature, small, bulbous excrescences to either side enhance the sweep of the scene by reminding us that just as there is an imagined space to either side, obscured by the frame, so too there is a before and after. The seemingly arbitrary extension of the scene to the right, which causes the long lances of the soldiers accompanying Christ to appear and disappear, not only represents a brilliant visual conceit, it propels the narrative onward and the reader to turn the page. The two-page spread was inspired in part by a panel from the Orsini Polyptych by Simone Martini that is known to have been in France in the 14th century. The Lambourgs, however, dissect the model, employing the architecture and the zigzag movement enhanced by the lobes of the frame for the scene on the left, the procession itself, for the scene on the right. Besides underscoring the contingency of artistic creation, the Lambourg's handling of these openings indicates an intense awareness of response as a means of structuring the experience of reading. So I would like to conclude with a series of openings that place the reader within their pages. In the dismembered Hours of Étienne Chevalier, Jean Fouquet employs architecture, the cloth of honor, and isocephaly to link one side with the other. In the Hours of Simon de Varry, the space is less continuous. In contrast to the patron, who occupies a relatively deep space enhanced by the woman in the background holding his coat of arms, the Virgin sits sideways in a narrow slice of space defined front and back by the red curtain, and the two are separated from one another by the trellis in the gutter. Devotional pairings such as this have a long history. But for all that distinguishes Otto's Liber Precum from Simon de Varry's Hours, they resemble one another in placing the patron together with an attendant in a deeper space than the figure that forms the focus of their devotion. In the early Middle Ages, devotional images most commonly appear in the context of donation. Readers appear as patrons and recipients of books. Exceptional in this regard is the Psalter of Archbishop Egbert of Trier, written by the scribe Ruprecht in the late 10th century. It opens with a pair of two-page spreads in which, as it were, the book is passed up the sacred food chain, first from the scribe to Egbert, who has a square nimbus as a sign of his authority, and then from Egbert to Peter. In the Hours of Jean d'Evreux, a French royal manuscript dated around 1325, we find a series of openings used to develop a complex counterpoint between two interlocking cycles of imagery. On the versos, the Hours of the Passion, and on the rectos on the right, the Hours of the Virgin. In this tiny manuscript, it's only about that big, it's painted entirely in grisaille. The queen appears in a still tinier initial at the foot of the Virgin Mary, where she reads from her prayer book in devout imitation of the Virgin in the temple. By the late Middle Ages, any layman with the means to commission such a book could assume such pretensions. This late 12th century Psalter from Fécamp in France offers a precocious example of female patronage. The recipient looms larger than the sacred figures who filled the Beatus initial on the facing page. And just to show you one last example, rather poignant, this is a book of hours from Rouen from the early 15th century. We see here the patron on the left imitating Mary and the Annunciation on the right. It's ironic that despite this extraordinary display of heraldic frippery and finery, he's never been identified. Before closing my lecture, I wish to consider one last example of an opening of this type from the Brussels Hours of Jean Duc de Berry, illuminated at the beginning of the 15th century. Despite its modernity, the opening presents us with a resume of many of the pictorial strategies we have seen over the course of this lecture. The image is self-referential in that it shows the Duke in profile, praying in front of an open book opposite a frontal image of the Virgin. Represented in grisaille, a technique for which there was a long tradition at the French court, the figures stand out against the blue and red grounds, which in turn emulate the figurations of basse-taille enamel, another Parisian specialty. That the Virgin represents a cult image can be deduced from a small ivory in the Louvre that seems to copy the same prototype, recognizable on the basis of its particular combination of attributes, the nursing Christ child, which refers to the incarnation, and the writing on the scroll, which refers to his divinity as the Logos. In its structure, the opening in the Brussels Hours represents a diptych, and in addition to its references to other media, sculpture, enamel, and ivory, it also refers to panel paintings, such as the contemporary Wilton diptych, an English work commemorating Richard II, but perhaps painted by an artist trained in Paris. A comparison of diptychs such as these to a work such as Jan van Eyck's Roland Madonna, dated around 1432, reveals fundamental similarities and differences. Like an opening in a manuscript, van Eyck's panel confronts donor and saint. The difference, however, is that the gutter dividing one from the other has disappeared, leaving its trace only in the checkered pavement that draws our eye deep towards the horizon. The book no longer defines space. It has been subsumed into the seamless illusion of a world in which seeing is now more important than reading. We can no longer turn the page. A cloying painting by Charles Alston Collins, Convent Thoughts, painted in 1851, sums up these developments. Set in a garden enclosed by a high hedge, and featuring a statuesque woman at the center, framed by flowers, rendered in remarkable detail, the pre-Raphaelite work is uncannily reminiscent not only of Jan van Eyck's painting of the Madonna at the fountain, but also, on account of its flower-strewn frame, the borders of a late 15th century Flemish manuscript of the kind the distracted nun is in danger of letting slip into the mirror-like surface of the pond, which doubles as an image of the painter's extraordinarily precise art. Its pages clasped between her fingers, the book opens to reveal two miniatures, one of the Annunciation, the other of the Crucifixion. In some ways, the painting seems to be a descendant of Metz's money changer, except that in this case, it is not clear what the daisy she contemplates represents, be it the charms of the natural world or lost love, If it's lost love, it's the painters rather than the nuns, because he was hopelessly in love with the model, Maria Rossetti, who was the sister of Dante Gabriel Rossetti. And that would make the narcissism of this painting the artist rather than the nuns. The book is no longer the focus of the nuns' attention. Despite its anecdotal quality, the painting and its public are focused on the book of nature. No doubt Jeff Bezos is right. The book turns out to be an incredible device. When I asked one of my children what distinguished the Amazon Kindle from the books that she was used to, she replied, quite simply, "It can't do pop-ups." Looking at this extraordinary opening from a 15th century Italian treatise on memory, which looks rather like a pop-up doll's house, one can only concur with my daughter and with Bezos' judgment, yet at the same time marvel at the ability of the spaces opened up by books, real and imaginary, to create effects that are simply not possible on a flat screen. Like this opening, like every illuminated opening, the illuminated manuscript opens up a series of perspectives, each providing a space for projection and reflection. This lecture has been devoted to books of a bygone age, but we shouldn't, I would argue, write off the book as an historical curiosity. Even as we turn the page on the Codex and enter the brave new world of the digital book, the Codex as we have known it, openings and all, will continue to find a future. Thanks.
This is WBUR. You've been listening to a lecture presented by the Program in Scripture and the Arts in the Department of Religion at Boston University. Speaking was Jeffrey Hamburger, Kuno Franke Professor of German Art and Culture at Harvard University. Professor Hamburger's lecture was titled Openings. We began with an introduction by Department of Religion Chair Deanna Klepper. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Tota and Michael Garth, with help from Jared Mooney. Our web producer is Angel Cazelli. The executive producer for Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydotis. I'm Deborah Becker. Thanks for joining us.